You've worked with over 20,000 educators and teachers to train them on things and help them understand ways they can bring life skills curriculum into the traditional school. And first, the thing I want to ask you is just what are the biggest challenges and struggles you hear from those educators about, you know, bringing life skill development into their classrooms?
The most thing that I hear is it's just one more thing. Part of, you know, this work is really sort of helping the practitioners. And that's everybody from the school leaders at the building and district level to the teachers in the classroom, to the aides, to the parents, right? To really understand that just because we've always done it this way doesn't mean that's the way we should be doing it now, right? So part of it is getting everybody to recognize and to give people the autonomy, right? There's the same agency we want in our kids, we want in our adults. And so we're really trying to work with them to say, let it go. Use an example. I'm the biology teacher, right? Imagine all the skills we can roll into the instruction of biology, all the content you have to teach, not a problem. We can roll all these pieces and parts into that if we step back from the pacing guide or the standardized curriculum and say, let's redesign the teaching of biology to make sense in our community with our learners right now today, and also infuse the skills that we know that they need to go off and be successful. And oh, by the way, let's make it so desirable that those kids can't wait to walk in the door.
Yeah. I love of
we can do all of that,
yeah,
right?
We can. And
we,
you know, and that's actually, that's one of the reasons that I do so much public facing stuff. It's why I built up social media, is because I want people to see this on a grander scale to be able to realize, like, oh, you're right. We don't have to do exactly the same thing we've always been doing. And if we kind of can get this more in the public eye, and as you said, get not just administrators and teachers, but parents engaged and kids to understand, like, oh, we could do this. Otherwise, I know there's at least one super hardworking teacher out there saying, I'm doing everything I can to make my science class a place where kids feel alive and engaged, and they're working on a real world problem and they're doing that. But again, just not being replicable is the challenging part.
Welcome to the Future of Education podcast, hosted by Mackenzie Price. Mackenzie is the founder of a revolutionary new school model that's disrupting education through AI. Join us as we discuss the latest in education innovation.
The other thing I think for me gets frustrating about hanging out in the traditional education world is that there's so often times where we just are stuck in the muck of, yes, this is hard. This is tough to do. It's not that. I don't like hanging out in that world, so I really try not to. And the same goes for this podcast, because I think parents listening to this right now or teachers are going, yeah, I know you're singing the choir. This is a problem and it's hard to do. What are some of the actionable steps that you believe parents can take? Listening to this, say, you know what? I may not have the PASS facility in Columbus, Ohio near me, or I may not have an Alpha school, you know, in my city or whatever. I'm in the heart of a traditional school system. What do you say to those parents?
Yeah. So, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote Hacking School. It's really funny because I put off putting that book out for years. It's based on all of the case studies, the stuff, the work of the work, right?
And why did you put it off? What was the reason?
You know, part of it is because oftentimes traditional educators don't want to hear that, right? And I understand that perspective, because this is not about teachers being bad. The work that we're talking about is not, in fact, to your point, amazing humans are heroes in so many ways. But the system itself can often just chew them up, spit them out. It's awful. And it's really, really hard to day after day get beat up. And I think that a lot of educators, especially right now, feel really, really beat up. And so part of it was a balance of saying, this is all about celebrating what you're doing. But at the same time, it's also calling out why we have to have some pretty radical systems change for us to really move forward. So that was just a bit of, how's this all going to be perceived? But back to your question, you know, so I wrote that for educators, for parents, for folks in the community that wanted to be able to have something in their hand or an example that they could touch on that says, we can do this differently, and here's how it could possibly work. And so the five strategies that are in the book, they're not new. I tell educators all that, you've all heard of these. In fact, you're using many of them. What's different is pulling them all together. And that's the trend that I see. Because to write Hacking School, about 300 interviews-ish to pull that book together, my underlying question was, when I look out in the world and I see these really amazing educational programs, initiatives, or these schools that are just the place everybody wants to be, to your point earlier, what is it that makes them so special? What's the magic? Or is there some magic in there? And I also wanted to know, and what makes them last 10 years or more? Because a lot of these great things, they flash up, as you well know, from your own work, and then they're great. And then the person that led it or who was the passionate leader behind it, they leave and the whole thing falls apart.
Yes.
Maybe not immediately, but within 2 or 3 years, you can't even find it anymore. And I wanted to understand that phenomenon. And so, you know, one of the things that I found is that the ones that last 10 years or more, every single one, no matter where in the world I was talking with or to, they had these five things.
Okay.
They had other things.
Tell me so the five things.
Yeah. So the five things are, they start with student agency. The entire program is based on students having agency, you know, beyond just voice and choice, but true learning, scaffolded autonomy and self-advocacy. Really important.
Hugely important. And it changes the culture of a school when kids have that sense of ownership. It changes their behavior. It changes the way they interact. It enriches the lessons that kids learn when they've had something happen. We just had an article came out recently in Arizona where one of our guides in our Arizona school was saying that he had watched a group of students, you know, struggle with each other relationally. And instead of stepping right in, it was afterwards they got together in a town hall and talked through it. And the kids who were struggling with this behavior, you know, asked for accountability because they realized. But that takes more time to develop, which again is hard for teachers to add another thing to do around that. But that's a great thing. Student agency is great. So Dr. Corbin, agency is so important. What's an example of a way that that can be infused? Just to help us kind of wrap our eyes around it.
Sure. The simplest form of agency that an educator can use is literally giving students a choice. So it may be as simple as we're going to study cell replication. And at the end of that, you can take a test, you can write a paper, you can do a presentation. Basic. But it's the element of choice that is providing agency. That's a simple way to do it. And that's a baby step. And I applaud any educator that even wants to do it. But there could be so much more because as you start to scaffold, and scaffolding of students means we're going to give them small pieces of an experience that allows them to build their confidence and their comfort in having more and more of something, right? Mm-hmm. So in the case of agency, that same example, instead of saying, hey, you get three choices on how you're going to demonstrate to me that you understood the lesson of cell replication, what if instead I toss up the standard on my giant whiteboard that we have to address in this classroom for this topic today? And together we design the entire lesson.
Yes.
I toss it to you and you say, how would you tackle learning how to understand cell replication? At that point, your students have had enough experiences, bigger and bigger experiences in owning the learning, and you shifting away from being that content expert to literally being that facilitator or that guide and learning with them, that suddenly they have the ability to teach that lesson.
That's a great thing to do. Okay, what are the other strategies? You said there's five. What else?
There's five. I use them in order. Not everybody does, but I think it's really important and I have a reason for that. But the next one is all around cultural relevancy or resiliency, whichever term you prefer. And that's really all about knowing who your students are and understanding the context in which they come to you. What's their background? What's the things they're passionate about? What are their interests? What languages do they speak? What are their cultural traditions? When you have cultural relevancy, it makes it possible for you as the educator to make sure that what you're teaching, you can actually connect it back to the kids themselves. Otherwise, you're not going to have engagement. And we see this time and time again. Great examples of this. One of my favorite ones that I use to sort of illustrate this is, now, if you are living in Florida, you know all about the beach and you know all about surfing, you know all about skateboarding. But if the lesson in the book about slope is about snow skiing, Your kids may not get it. That's just a simple example. But it's really around having the wherewithal as the educator to know your kids deeply enough to know the modifications I need to make so my kids will care about what we're talking about.
I think that's a great point. An example we see on that is one of the commitments we have is kids will love school. Mm-hmm. And we survey our students and then we'll ask, would you rather go to school or go on vacation? And, you know, we have certain school populations where vacation is not a thing that they're really aware of. And how do you mm-hmm. make sure to connect mm-hmm. that? Versus we also have, you know, some very high end private school places where it's like, well, are we going to Europe or are we going to Mexico? You know, what's going on? And that is something that I think is so important. It's one of the things that is challenging for teachers to find that time to mm-hmm. really get to connect and understand what are you all about? What's your family about? Those types mm-hmm. of things. I think that's true. Certainly you can have some of that in the school, but I think that cultural relevancy is a great one. What's number three?
So number three is mastery. So we really work with our schools and our school partners to get away from the things that we measure. That's a whole nother conversation you and I can have. We're measuring the wrong thing largely. But my point really is to get away from that sort of traditional grade-based understanding that, you know, we've got 2 days to talk about this topic and then we're going to take a test or some type of assessment and then we're going to move on without allowing the students to really be ready to move on. So we really advocate for a mastery or competency-based approach to thinking about eliminating the time constraint of learning. So mastery-based of some description is the third one that we see, again, in the places that are super successful. Doesn't mean they don't have grades. That's not what we're suggesting. But what it does mean is that the learning journey is uncoupled from time.
Right. And that's a direct criticism of the traditional time-based system mm-hmm. as opposed mm-hmm. to having mastery before you move forward. And the time-based system, which is, of course, what almost all
Carnegie?
Of us grew up with, that is my Goliath that I am trying to kill, mm-hmm. you know, right dead between the eyes. Okay, number four.
And then number four is transdisciplinary teaching and learning. This is the one that I see teachers go, and I'm like, okay, come on. This one's really important.
What is it?
Transdisciplinary teaching and learning.
Oh, transdisciplinary. Okay, great. Tell me.
Right. And so basically all this means is the real world, nobody rings a bell and we do some math, and then nobody rings a bell and then we do some English, and nobody rings a bell and then we do science, so on and so forth. It's really the de-siloing of all the content that we have to teach. It doesn't mean I don't have a math teacher. It doesn't mean that I don't have, you know, an English teacher or so on. What it means is that within the content that we're teaching, we are connecting it to the other things that our students are learning. It's transdisciplinary. It's understanding that to solve great problems, we have to have multiple disciplines, thinking, solutions, problems, and understanding to really be able to tackle. And so the places that de-silo or uncouple content have much more robust learning experiences and engagement with their students, and therefore those programs persist.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons we had so much success with one of the programs we introduced last year. We're doing it again this year, which is running a food truck business.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And I mean, they're learning math, they're learning science, they're learning, mm-hmm. you know, life skills, all kinds of different activities that make that interesting. And I actually think that point is probably one that parents can help with
Absolutely.
At home, because mm-hmm. that's everything from, hey, let's do a lemonade stand this weekend.
Right.
Suddenly you're marketing and you're writing and you're mixing and, you know, mm-hmm. you can throw in a chemistry lesson. You know, there's a lot of ways to kind of encourage that. I think it's a really great one to do. And what is the fifth strategy?
And then
you believe
the
is
fifth
important?
One is problem based, right? And so we use problem based as a big umbrella, and that can be anything from, you know, exploration, project based, hands on. The problem-based umbrella, and the reason we tap into that is because to really, really get to a place that loves and thinks about those big, hairy, audacious, wicked problems, it's going to take a lot of small pieces and parts to really get to the ability to solve the problem. And so it's a scaffolded approach to say, look, if you are a school or a program that really embraces problem-based learning, then you are going to really understand all of those other elements. And so it's the umbrella that really drives all of those pieces and parts. It's that applied teaching and learning. It's hands-on. Your example of a food truck, that's beautiful problem-based learning at its best right there, right? Because it's very comprehensive. It's complex. And it allows the students to tackle and solve for many things. I have to understand the math. How many peppers do I need to buy to go into my sandwich that I'm making, or so on and so forth? And so problem-based learning is just really this great vehicle to also then tap into the passions and the interests of the students and the communities, the needs, but also the educators.
Yeah.
It's a great vehicle.
Those five strategies are so important. I love that you couple them together, because when you do, that's when you see true and real change. I think the challenge that I would imagine, and listening to you talk about this, is like, this all is great. And, you know, I was able to go create a new system where we are doing a great job on all of those things. But I bet you the average teacher is going, okay, how am I going to get all five of these things in my school? You know, and how do we change that system again? Where are you seeing success in that?
So we're seeing success in a couple of different places, right? So we have some really innovative schools or districts, traditional districts that are like, we're just ready.
Great.
Our families are leaving in droves. And that is really one of the big kickers. And you talk about what can families do? Vote with your feet. If you have the ability, you don't always, and let's understand that not every family has the ability to say, hey, my kid can't go to the school just down the street because I can't even get them there. There's a whole host of real life constraints. But the reality is we can often vote with our feet and demand change. So we see and are working with entire school districts that are like, we're just going to get the pass from our state and we're going to do something different. But the easier place to make this change, in all honesty, is at the individual classroom level. And do it by starting small. Take a something that you need to teach and sit down with that something. Go through it and say, how do I add agency? How do I ensure that it's culturally relevant? And start making the tweaks to the unit itself.
I think that is such great advice. And again, I have so much respect for the people that are, you know, the heroes in the classroom every day trying to find ways to do this. I also do think that parents can absolutely raise their hands to say, hey, we need something different. That's exactly my story from, you know, 12 years ago. And I will say that the teachers and administrators at my old school did not necessarily like running into me in the hallways because of that. But eventually it was like, okay, this is time to go move into something different. We have to do something different on that. And it's great. Well, I cannot thank you enough, Dr. Corbin, for the work that you're doing. I now have a reason to go to Columbus, Ohio, which
Please do.
To say wasn't on my 2026 bucket list, but maybe it is now. And I love what you're doing. And I hope that this can be inspirational for other people. The other thing that you mentioned around getting students in real world environments, that's a place we also see a lot of parent connection helping with that. And so if you are a parent who's listening to this at home, or you're an educator listening to this, oftentimes if you reach out to the parents in your kids' group, that's where you can see some incredible opportunities for them to get real world experience and, you know, just solve problems. So, well, thanks for your help. I love that you are part of reimagining the future of education. I think it's going to actually be a beautiful, exciting world in the future. We just got to get people not scared of it, right?
Exactly. Not scared. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Mackenzie Price and the Future of Education podcast. If you haven't hit that subscribe button, now is the time to do it so you can stay up to date on all our episodes. You can connect with Mackenzie on social media and be part of our daily conversation over on Instagram at futureof_education. Lastly, if you're loving what you're learning, please leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be back in your feed soon, but until then, remember, kids are limitless, and it's our job to unlock their potential.